Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. 6 years ago, lawmakers gave the nod to mail-in ballots. Now President Trump says he may issue an executive order doing away with voting machines and vote by mail. We hear from the state elections chief about what it would take to go back to walk-in voting. We take a closer look at organ transplants, what you need to know about the wait lists and surgeries here in Hawaii. We learn about how an effort to restore a watershed area in Maui is helping a community heal. Plus, this month's tsunami alert turned our attention to emergency sirens. Why did some not sound the warning? And do you remember when you got the alert on your phone about the false missile alert of years ago? We revisit that day. A new musical about the mistaken alert opens next month in New York. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. President Donald Trump renewed his campaign against mail-in ballots, saying he's considering an executive order to do away not just with voting by mail, but voting machines as well. Here in Hawaii, if you recall, lawmakers changed election laws to embrace mail-in voting, and that was 6 years ago. We talked to our state elections chief, Scott Nago, about what it would take to go back to in-person voting. Nago told us it would not be easy. Just securing the leases for precincts is something that's normally done years in advance. When you first heard this, what did you think? Because there's been this big push to go to mail-in ballots, and the voters seem to have responded.
Yeah, so Hawaii has actually had a very long history with voters voting by mail. 2019, the legislature enacted vote by mail, but it actually goes back further than that to 1993 when they implemented no excuse absentee voting. So prior to that, you needed a reason to vote by absentee mail. In 1993, they implemented no excuse, so anybody who wanted to vote either by mail or in person at an early vote site could do that without having an excuse. So Hawaii's always had that strong vote-by-mail or absentee voting presence.
And then the other thing that the president mentioned is that he wants to do away with voting machines. And we have long used voting machines as well.
Yes, going all the way back to the 80s when we went from punch card, and then in the 90s we switched over to Mark Sense. And I believe federal law required us to switch over to Mark Sense. The Help America Vote Act of 2022 actually encouraged states to move over to voting machines.
And so just the idea that we're going to have to go back to the old style, opening up precincts and all of that, I'm sure you probably were wondering what?
Yeah, like I said, voting by mail, there is a population of voters out there, whether it be people on vacation or voters with disabilities who actually need and rely on voting by mail, whether it be because they're not in their state at the time or they need those assistive technologies to help them vote. So there is a population that actually would prefer voting by mail.
It is a bit of a head scratcher. You know, I mean, we've made these improvements, right, to the system. The voters have responded, right? A good number of voters opt to do it by mail.
Correct. I mean, if you look back at the numbers, I'm going all the way back to the 2014 election, more people actually voted prior to election day than they did on election day. And then when you look at the vote by mail numbers, or something that probably overlooked is the first vote by mail elections was not in 2020. It was actually in 2010. That was a special election for the U.S. Rep District 1, which had a turnout of 171,000 voters. And if you want to compare that to a previous special election, which wasn't conducted by mail, there was only 76,000. So almost double of that voted because it was a vote by mail election.
Yeah, and you're trying to make it easier for people.
Yeah, we're trying to maximize access.
And when we did it the old way, you have to staff the precincts, right? You have volunteers. It's a major undertaking to go back to the old style.
Correct. We usually reserve the polling places 2 years in advance. So once the election is over, we'll go back we would have to start reserving polling places and start recruiting precinct officials to work the polling places, as well as get people to open up the polling place so that people can vote.
Well, I have to admit, I was one of the reluctant voters because I really enjoyed going out to the precincts. I enjoyed being out there and seeing my neighbors and casting your vote. It's our right. Free elections. That's what this country was built on. But I did quickly adapt to voting by mail. And so I see now the ease at which you can just do this, do your homework, you know, figure out who you're going to vote for, and then just send it in or drop it in. I like to drive up to City Hall and drop my ballot in the box.
Yeah, so previously voters were under that time crunch to make their decisions in the voting booth. Now they can, they receive their ballot, they can take the time to study it, they can look up, do their research, and then they can vote without the pressures of having to do it in the voting booth with a long line behind you.
Yeah, and I like not having those long lines, but I know that, you know, there have been a few precincts where you've had people wait to the last minute and you've had to deal with that as well.
Yeah, so the voter service centers are open 10 days in advance. They're open on Saturdays. There's numerous voter service centers throughout the island. We ask that if you do vote in person, don't wait till the last minute because that's when we tend to see the big long lines, especially at the end of the day, 7 p.m. or 6, the last hours of voting on election day. That's when you see the longest lines.
When you first heard about this idea that the president may issue an executive order to eliminate not just the machines, but mail-in voting, what did you think?
I really didn't have the opportunity to think that much. It was puzzling because as an election official, our job is to maximize access to voting and to limit it to one day. And also, machines are objective. They're not subjective. So to count it, I'm assuming by hand, is going to be a subjective process, which we haven't hand-counted ballots since, I want to say, the 70s or maybe the 60s. So if you thought your results were going to come out late now, they'll probably be even later because we would have to verify all those hand counts.
Wow. I just remember those days of covering elections and watching all those ballots get deposited in. I think you folks had taxis, you know, special
yes.
transportation to deliver those ballots from the precincts over to the main office.
Yes, that was a big undertaking because we had to rent hundreds of those transportation vehicles to deliver and collect those ballots.
Yeah, and then you are often then making sure that, you know, there aren't ballot boxes that aren't accounted for, right? You want to know that everything got delivered safely.
Correct, and untampered.
So have you had an opportunity to talk to the Attorney General's office about what do our laws say and what to do if there is going to be an executive order that's issued?
That's not something that I normally would talk to the Attorney General's office regarding the constitutionality of the law. That's something that they would advise us on whether or not we would implement.
Okay, so that has yet to happen. And I guess we'll just wait to see if Hawaii is involved in another lawsuit over this, if it's a case of overreach, or if Congress decides that that's what they want to do.
Correct.
Given that the president maybe has indicated that he wants to see this for the upcoming election, I mean, that doesn't give us much wiggle room.
No, it's going to be a massive undertaking if we have to switch from our current model to a completely new model that would entail the recruiting, the training, all that, which the reserve, like I said, the reserving of the facilities, all that. And also the voter education and telling voters, it's a big difference from just receiving your ballot in the mail to having to go to a polling place on election day to vote.
That was Scott Nago, state elections chief, reacting to President Trump's comments this week that he's considering an executive order to eliminate voting by mail. We did reach out to the state attorney general's office. It issued a statement saying there is currently a stay in court over a move by the White House to require a citizenship check prior to voting, which also includes language to force states to exclude absentee or mail-in ballots. So stay tuned.
Florida's orange production is at its lowest point in more than a century. An industry critical to the Sunshine State's economy and culture is in crisis.
Literally, we may have 10 years left of citrus.
I'm Amory Sievertson. What's behind Florida's citrus decline? And is there any way to stop it? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
Things are changing in Europe. Trump has spooked the Europeans into thinking more seriously about their defense. And the idea of a threat from Russia that goes beyond Ukraine is starting to seep into the European psyche.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Hawaii News Now report recently found that nearly half of kidneys donated in Hawaii go to recipients on the continent. But the primary kidney transplant surgeon at Queens Medical Center says that's only half of the story. And in fact, Dr. Felix Lee says there's a bigger transplant crisis that we're not talking about. He's a co-author on a new study drawing attention to the low number of solid organ transplants in the U.S. Pacific Island territories. Despite residents having higher rates of kidney failure than those in the continental U.S., only 48 liver and kidney transplants were performed in 21 years. Lee and his co-author Dylan Bush presented these results at the World Transplant Congress in San Francisco earlier this month. They spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the research. Lee starts us off, beginning with context about Hawaii's transplant numbers.
What they did not say in detail is exactly the reason why that is. And it's not that we're basically giving organs to the mainland. That's not the case. So the way the U.S. transplant system works is that this is a nationalized system. So every time when there's organs available, actually there's a big center, you know, that goes through all the transplants recipients in the entire nation and see who the kidney can go to. So it's actually a national wait list. The UNO system prioritizes local recipients because they want the organ to stay locally. So generally, most of the times when we have an organ available, it stays with us. There are, however, exceptions. The exception is that sometimes someone may have antibodies in their blood that makes them very difficult to find the organ that suits them. These are patients we call highly sensitized. So for this highly sensitized patient, they may have to wait for more than 10 years for an organ offer, while someone else just needs to wait for 1 year. So it's also not really fair to them. So in those specific situations, if there's any organs in the nation that fits them, they will go to them first, no matter where they are. So for example, if I have an organ in Hawaii that fits a person in New York, for this type of highly sensitized patient, it will go to New York first before it comes to us. But vice versa is the same. If I have a patient in Hawaii with the organ in New York that fits this patient in Hawaii, it will come to Hawaii first before it goes to anyone else in New York. So that's the situation. But the thing is that we cannot think of Hawaii versus continental U.S. as one-to-one. There's over 250 programs, kidney transplant programs in the United States. It's one center versus 250 centers. What's the likelihood of someone, 250 centers, has a patient that needs this organ versus we do? I think from the news report, they say we're sending like 40 organs out for every one organs we get in. But if we actually look at that, we are actually keeping a lot of organs in than we're actually sending them out. We're top five in the nation in terms of keeping organs within our own area. So we are actually doing very well in keeping the organs here within our area. So that's one thing that the news report did not talk about. So I want to make it very clear. Two, the reason why organs go out, besides that reason, is because people die for a reason. So it's not that their organs are always 100% perfect. There are still different qualities of organs. So actually, the majority of times when organs go to other places from Hawaii is because those are organs that our patients do not want. But then the thing is that since that report has been out, we have people who have come to say, hey, what is going on? Why do I sign up for a donor? Is it for the organs just go out Hawaii and benefit someone else? But that's not the case, because ultimately, our ability to transplant our patients here in Hawaii is based on the number of donors. If we don't have enough donors, our patients here doesn't get transplanted. And if we don't have enough donors, we also won't have as many good kidneys. So ultimately, it's the patients here that gets hurt if we don't have enough donors. So we need to increase the number of people who are willing to donate so we have enough good organs that we can actually benefit the people here in Hawaii.
So Dylan, what got you interested in this issue, especially, I mean, you're in Rhode Island, so you're pretty far away from the Pacific and thinking about transplant issues there.
Yeah, definitely Rhode Island, a different sort of island than the Pacific Islands. So I've been doing work in the Pacific since 2018, when I first went to Solomon Islands as a study abroad student when I was an undergraduate, actually. And then I went back to Solomon Islands and I did a Fulbright between 2022 and 2023, during which I studied surgical systems and diabetic amputation. And I think that the U.S. Pacific Islands represent a unique example because the people living there are American citizens, or in the case of American Samoa, they're American nationals. And so theoretically, they should have similar access to those of us living here on the mainland or in Hawaii. But what I found was that really wasn't true. And particularly when it comes to organ transplantation, I think, as we'll talk about, there's a number of barriers for those patients. What we were able to find is that with regards to kidney disease, end-stage renal disease, which is the disease that necessitates transplant, around 6 out of every 10,000 people in the U.S. Pacific Island territories have end-stage renal disease and would theoretically need a transplant, whereas this number is only 4 out of every 10,000 in the 50 states. Additionally, of course, there's no transplant centers or organ procurement organizations in the U.S. Pacific Island territories. That means that patients have to relocate, often thousands of miles, for care. And when we looked at the actual rates of transplantation in the territories, we saw that only 48 liver and kidney transplants were performed over a 21-year period. And so just about 1 out of every 1,000 patients living in the U.S. Pacific Island territories who needed a kidney actually got a kidney in 2021, whereas 300 out of every 1,000 waitlisted patients were transplanted in the 50 states.
And Dr. Lee, if you have anything to add there or just expand a little bit on kind of the human aspect here, because it's one thing to take a look at the numbers and say that over the course of 2 decades, you've had double digits of transplants. But what does it feel like for patients to be on that list and to know that they might be getting better care if they live somewhere else?
So absolutely, I completely agree with Dylan. I'm actually very thankful for him to approach me about doing this project, because when I'm practicing here, I'm always have some idea of there are also patients out there, but exactly what's going on. But this opportunity really allowed me to in depth into the issue. Yes, I completely agree with Dylan. So with the amount of basically kidney disease burdens here in the Pacific Island territories, there's definitely not enough transplants to satisfy the need for a transplant. But also the other thing that we found was that when Dylan was telling me, oh, there's only so few patients that got transplanted in the U.S. Pacific Islands, I was actually shocked, because I was thinking, in my own experience here in Hawaii, I know I've transplanted patients from Guam, from the U.S. Pacific Island territories, from the Kofan nations. I know because I see them. But yet when I went to the database, they are not documented as such, because by getting on the transplant list, they basically have to move here to Hawaii. So now they are recorded as a Hawaii resident. So that number for me got skewed. But the thing is that even though that may be the case, but it still doesn't change the fact that there are a lot more patients who have needs for kidney transplant on this island territories, but they don't have access to it. In terms of the human aspect of things, it is very difficult, because a lot of times when patients come to see me for transplant evaluation, they are not aware of how involved the process of transplant is. Transplant surgery is not a one-time thing. It's actually, as my coordinator says, it's a lifelong commitment. even after a transplant surgery, we still have to put a patient on lifelong medications that prevent their body from fighting the new organ. And they're very good at what they do, but they also have a lot of potential side effects that can make people very sick very fast if they're not careful. So we as a center takes a lot of care for these patients to make sure they actually do well for the long term after surgery. So a lot of times when I come to talk to patients about this, they suddenly a light bulb went on their heads in their heads saying, oh, I didn't know transplant is so involved. But that also means that after transplant, if I want to make sure things do well, I may not be able to go home. But having said that, we do have patients that wait on the US Pacific Islands for the transplant. But again, one of the issues is with transport, right? When we have an organ that becomes available, we cannot hold the organ here for them forever. There's only a certain amount of time the organ can work. And the time when we find out organ is available to the time for transplant is maybe 1 to 2 days max. So when we know that becomes available, we'll tell the patients, say, hey, we have this organ for you, please come in. But what if there's no flights available and they cannot come in? What to do? Sometimes, unfortunately, they may have to give up the organ and let the organ go to the person next on the list. We do have patients who have experienced that and for a couple of times, but then ultimately they decided they do have to come closer, relocated to where this transplant center is. So at least they will not miss out on the organs. But unfortunately, these are all a lot of things logistics, and it also unfortunately comes with the fact that our backyard is very big and there's the transportation is not the greatest, which is a significant barrier.
Yeah, that's so, it's an issue I didn't even think about, of the need for transplant leading to relocation, or if they're in like later stage disease mm-hmm. and need to receive dialysis multiple times a week, but there's no dialysis center where they live. There's so many issues here, but how do you start thinking about solutions?
Unfortunately, in terms of solutions, there's not much active work going on in this area, and that's sort of why we wrote the paper. We really hope that this paper can serve as sort of a catalyst for change by encouraging us all in medicine, in health systems, in governments, and policies, and in NGOs as well, to think about how we can improve transplant access for patients living in the Pacific Islands. And so one potential way to do that is to expand the accessibility of telehealth. Other options that we talked about in the paper and that we felt could help improve the situation was things like collaborating with local providers. So although there are nephrologists, those are kidney doctors, and there are a limited number of gastroenterologists, those are GI docs, like in places like Guam, there isn't anyone, at least that we were able to find, that is transplant specific and working specifically with transplant patients. But of course, there is a huge team of incredible experts at Dr. Lee's institution, Queens, that could theoretically help to manage patients remotely by working with local providers. That would mean building relationships with these providers, setting up networks to communicate with them, and also navigating some challenges in terms of insurance and reimbursement. But coordinating care from an expert center like Queens with the help of local providers could offer a way for us to deliver specialty medicine care specifically for transplant patients in the Pacific Islands. And then certainly increasing living donor donation is another way to get more organs for patients. Increasing awareness of living donor donation and increasing acceptability within the U.S. Pacific Islands could also potentially help us to deliver care and to get more organs for these patients living in the U.S. Pacific Islands. One final note about all of these solutions is that a lot of this is going to have to involve increasing and improving the infrastructure in these territories, specifically the healthcare infrastructure. So enhancing the lab capacity, the availability of medications, insurance coverage, and the availability of local practicing providers would be really vital to any sort of sustainable solution to provide care for these patients and for patients in general living in the U.S. Pacific Islands.
And that's a big lift. That was medical student Dylan Bush and Queens Medical Center kidney transplant surgeon Felix Lee. They spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about the need for organ transplants in the Pacific. We'll have a link to their research on our website after the show. Our next story is about healing in more ways than one. HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel had an opportunity to spotlight a reforestation project on Maui and joins us now. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so you were there in Kula earlier this month.
I was. So the story is about the Kula Community Watershed Alliance. We've been following along with their work over the past couple of years since the fire. It's a group of over 70 neighbors and fire survivors in Kula, and they have grouped together to form the alliance. It's literally a really grassroots effort, and they've done so much over the past couple of years. They invited me to join them for a blessing of their new restoration nursery. It just so happened to be on the two-year anniversary of the wildfires on August 8th. Executive Director Sarah Tecula says that they have these two 60-foot-long hoop houses. They're in this beautiful pasture in Kula, and that will one day, they'll grow over the course of, the next decades, they'll grow tens of thousands of native plants and trees to create a thriving native forest in Kula over these 120 acres of Alliance land. And again, that's, all land that's owned by individuals, neighbors that have formed the Alliance. And it'll also have a community tool library for, folks to come and borrow tools. They will host volunteer and education groups here. It's a really beautiful spot. And, the event was really thanking and recognizing, the community members who have been a part of it, as well as the funders who have joined them along the way to make it successful. Really beautiful evening, music from Hawaiian musicians like Uncle George Kahumoku, Under the Rising Moon, a really beautiful setting. Sarah Bryan is board president of Nakoa Manu Conservation. It's a nonprofit that supports a lot of conservation initiatives on Maui, like the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project, Maui Invasive Species Committee, Retree Hawaii, a lot of kind of familiar names that they're involved in supporting. One of their partner projects is also the Kula Community Watershed Alliance, and Sarah Bryan talked about the organization's work.
The Kula Community Watershed Alliance gathered, listened, and formed an informal entity and requested our partnership all within the short month after the devastating fires. That's incredible. And they have formed what is truly a remarkable alliance. There are over 70 different landowners that have been affected here, and this alliance has worked with every single one. The care, patience, and commitment that this community has shown each other is something that I think it made it a perfect project to partner with us here at Nakoa Manu. Since they joined our partner projects in September of 2023, again, 1 month after they have gone through so much, our services have enabled them to accept funds from 262 individual donors, 20 different organizations and businesses, and over $1.4 million in grants. They're to be spent here in this community to not only stabilize and protect the burned areas and beyond, but to also build an understanding of the historical record of this land and its people, and to build a foundation of community response for uncertain climate times.
I love this because it really does help to grow hope in the community, given what we've gone through with the disasters.
Absolutely. And, growing plants is something that, a lot of Alliance members have found really healing. Before the nursery became formalized, they have been growing a lot of plants in their own backyards, already done a lot of outplanting in a lot of these burned areas in Kula. And, they found it to be, like you said, a really healing process, healing the land, healing themselves after, as they recover, walk this road of recovery in the years to come. As Sarah Bryan mentioned, a lot of research has gone into this to not only find out the best methods for growing these natives in this particular area, but also what the landscape used to look like. So, one of the board members talked about, they want to restore it not only to what it was before the fire, but to what it was historically, this native forest. One of the partners in this effort has been Skyline Conservation Initiative, which is the Zipline Company, which is right up the hill from the Watershed Alliance. But they have, along with Zipline, they have successfully restored a native forest. Joe Imhoff is project advisor at the Kula Community Watershed, but also program manager at Skyline Conservation portion of what they do. And so a lot of the seeds that will be grown there at the nursery were gathered at Skyline. You know, it's kind of a proof of concept that they have already done successfully since, I believe, 2002, early 2000s. They started this effort of restoring, you know, what used to be there. It's really cool and exciting to think about. The Kula Community Watershed has also been gifted, along with growing seeds, has been gifted some rare plants that we hardly see anymore. You know, one of them is Nalpaka kuahivi. You know, we're often familiar with the nalpaka that grows by the beach. The kuahivi is the partner plant that grows in the mountains. There's a whole mo'olelo behind it, but they will be they planted that rare plant at the blessing, and you know, it'll be growing up to have seeds that they'll be able to continue to plant in the area. So at the nursery blessing, Imhoff talked about all the recent accomplishments of the Alliance and the projects that they've done.
We've had a lot of milestones this year. Just the space that we're in. Last year was just a field, and we blessed the space, and now we have this facility. So the building of this facility, two hoop houses, was a whole lot of work. Thank you to the Skyline crew and to Josh, the contractor. Like, this is a major, major effort. In addition to this, we've cleared a fire break the entirety of this property. There's a 50-plus foot wide fire break from the top all the way to the bottom. So there's now defensible space. If there's ever another fire that gets reignited anywhere on this property, emergency vehicles will be able to access. And when it happened 2 years ago, there was no access, and they had to do emergency bulldozing work all over the place. Yeah, and the fence. the fence is something that's happening right now as we speak. It's an 8-foot tall deer fence, and this is the first unit that's getting protected. And within the next couple months, there's more funds that are coming online, and we're going to build the fence all the way top to bottom along where the fire break is. So we're going to be able to keep the entire herd of deer from even entering into the valley anymore. This entire landscape scale restoration site will be deer free, and that is really the first step in making this successful.
I forgot about the deer. Ugh.
Can't forget about them. So many trials along the way, but they're well on their way to making this a really, really successful project.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for highlighting this, Catherine.
Thanks so much.
We've been talking to HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. You can find her story about the restoration project on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, committed to the conservation and protection of water resources for Oahu. Learn more about how to reduce water waste at boardofwatersupply.com.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. What was it like to be middle-aged in the Middle Ages?
I think one of the things that would be shocking would be probably the level of casual cruelty.
And if you could travel back 600 years, would you go?
I guess I would, yeah, because it's a much simpler life.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Now on view, Mary Cassatt at Work. The Impressionist dared to take the lives of women seriously as subject matter for her art. HonoluluMuseum.org.
This morning, Honolulu Civil Beat's lead story has a headline that one in five emergency sirens did not work during the recent tsunami scare. Reporter Blaise Lovell joins us to talk about this. Good morning, Blaise.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so that seems like a number that's not so good.
Yeah, it's quite a bit. And, you know, after the most recent test, when this data was made available by the state, we got some calls from folks who said they couldn't hear the sirens or they didn't hear them. It turned out when we looked, they were living near sirens that were either broken or needed to be repaired or beyond repair and needed to be replaced. Now, to put things into context, Some folks that work in the emergency management space, you know, say that right now Hawaii is actually doing a lot better than it was a few years ago. In 2023, just after the Maui wildfires, there were a lot more sirens that were broken, close to 100. Right now, that number is more like 78 to 76 need to be repaired or replaced. So the state's been spending a lot of money to do that recently, upgrading the sirens, fixing ones that need to be repaired. But there are still, some that need to be fixed or completely replaced across the state.
Yeah, some might say, but that's unacceptable. I mean, you know, these are in areas that may not, you know, get alerts otherwise.
Right, and if you look at the map that the state has put out on the siren statuses, you know, most of the islands are in good shape. There's a lot of sirens, hundreds, so even if some are out, you could still hear them in the distance. But there's places like Palolo Valley, Aiea Heights, Pacific Palisades, and Pearl City, where I'm from, Makaha Valley, Barbers Point, parts of the North Shore, and Ko'olauloa districts. They have sirens that need to be replaced or fixed. On the Big Island, Hawaii, Waihinu on the south side, and parts of Leilani Estates where the lava flow destroyed them. West Maui, the permanent sirens were destroyed in a fire. They right now have mobile sirens in their place. And on Kauai, Hanalei, and an area where the Wailoa River have sirens that were knocked out. You know, a lot of those places are coastal inundation zones, places that would be hit by a tsunami. But others, you know, listeners might think or readers might think, well, you know, these are valleys or areas that are more inland. But residents there that we talked to, you know, are worried about the chance of a wildfire happening and, you know, the siren not being on like they were during Lahaina when they weren't used. Those 2023 fires have sort of, you know, brought the wildfire risk to the top of mind for people who live even in those inland areas.
Well, why does it take so long to, you know, replace the broken ones?
Well, one of the issues that the state's dealing with, according to James Barrows, he's the state emergency management administrator. He's in charge of the agency that is in charge of fixing these sirens, is that a lot of them are, you know, kind of old. So as soon as they fix or replace one, you know, new ones break, and then they have to go through the process all over again. Another thing is that, you know, Hawaii, we're surrounded by ocean, surrounded by seawater, so that starts to degrade the batteries and the various components over time. A lot of the sirens have been, you know, subject to vandalism, people stealing copper wires or the batteries, the expensive parts of it. But there is also, you know, some sirens that have been down for years. You know, we spoke to a resident in Palolo who said that the siren at the back of their valley, you know, they've been calling for repairs for the last 2 years. One in Palisades has been down for about three. So, you know, I can understand, you know, residents' concern and in a lot of instances frustration when you see these things that aren't being repaired. Lawmakers, after the wildfires in Maui, allocated about $10 million in the last 2 years to siren upgrades and repairs. The state is trying to buy bigger sirens to replace some of the aging ones. One of the other issues that's recently come up, though, is that a lot of the maintenance costs, at least half of the maintenance costs, was borne by funds paid from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And those funds have been targeted for cuts by the Trump administration. If that goes away, it could become harder for the state to repair these sirens in the future.
Well, that's not good news. I mean, gosh, you want to improve those odds, right? You don't want it to get worse.
Right, and to remind, you know, listeners, we have one of the largest integrated warning systems in the entire world that was created after some deadly tsunamis when people didn't have warnings. No state has a statewide outdoor warning system like we do. Most leave it up to local governments. You know, but that's also created a challenge. Like, how do you take care of an aging mechanical system? The counties now have these text alerts that people can sign up for. But the city and county of Honolulu told us that only about 90,000 people on Oahu have signed up for their county text alerts. So it's still to be seen, you know, how all these components will work together and what sorts of funding we'll see in the future.
Yeah, you want a layered effect, right, to make sure that people get the message. If there's an emergency or a disaster pending, they need to know.
Right, and in an ideal world, you know, the emergency management officials told us they want all three of those components working, the sirens, the text alerts, and, you know, when your phone starts beeping really loudly.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Blaise.
Thanks again.
That was Civil Beat reporter Blaise Lovell talking about the failures in the state siren system for tsunami warnings. We'll have a link to a story on our website later today. On the next Fresh Air, Spike Lee joins us to talk about his new film, Highest to Lowest, about a powerful music mogul targeted in a ransom plot who must fight for his family and his legacy. It's a reimagining of Akira Kurosawa's 1963 film, High and Low. We'll talk about the inspiration behind this film and Spike's others. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Everything, it seems, and I do mean everything, is on the table for Trump administration budget cuts.
When you're dealing with people who have critical medical needs, who don't have access to the physician whom they need to see, the hospital they need to go to, that's where the Essential Air Service provides a critical fulfillment.
I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the last and final boarding call. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Rehearsals for a new musical opening off Broadway began in New York today. The show is titled This Is Not a Drill. It was born out of the false missile alert that took place 7 years ago here in the islands. Take a listen. And a warning, this excerpt begins with the sound of an alarm.
The computer screen flashes. Send emergency alert.
Do I press the button? Well, that's why I'm here.
I have the power. God, what do I do with it?
Are you sure you want to send that alert?
The U.S. Pacific Command has detected a missile threat to Hawaii. A missile may impact on land or sea within minutes. This is not a drill. If you're indoors, stay indoors. If you're outdoors, seek immediate shelter in a building.
You know, we got the chance to talk to the writer of the show. Holly Dubé was here in the islands with her husband at the time of the alert. The incident affected her so much that she decided to write about it. She recalled that she phoned her sons to say goodbye. Out of that came the song, This You Should Know. Here's Holly.
I don't know how you responded to that thing, but I got total PTSD from it, just from the adrenaline, I guess, but I was exhausted for 2 weeks, and then when I got up and felt better, I thought to myself, this would be the perfect musical, and that's what I did, and it took me 2 years to write it.
This was a very emotional moment for many people, but take our listeners back to when you heard this and what you did.
When I heard the alarm, I said, let's put our fanny packs on and put our driver's license in there in case our torsos are found. That's what I said.
You felt compelled to reach out. Tell our listeners about how you tried to get a hold of your children to say goodbye.
Yeah, it was very, I just say it was surreal. First of all, I remember thinking, is it going to hurt when we blow up? Is it going to hurt? I didn't know. But we were running to, there was one room at this place that we were staying that had four walls. And we were running to get to that room, which was probably about 15 by 15, very small. But on the way, I called my sons, and funny story, actually, I called my younger son, who always picks up the phone when I call, and he didn't pick up. And then I called my older son, who never picks up, and he picked up. So he was the one that I ended up talking to. And when I told him there was a bomb, that we got an official bomb alert from the state of Hawaii, he thought I was kidding. I mean, it was so outrageous, right? So he said, oh, come on, Mom. And I said, no, it's real. And I told him we'd gotten an alert. And I said, I don't have time to talk right now, but we're trying to find a place to shelter. But, you know, like I said, I just want you and your brother to know that you've been the best part of my life and I love you. And I said, but let me go so we can find a place, try to find a place to shelter. And so then immediately after I hung up and I was sobbing, he sent me a text and said, Mom, please find a safe place. I love you so much.
And out of that experience came that song, You
yes,
Should Know.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This You Should Know, because I really didn't have a long conversation with my son because things were so intense. But the song is basically, what would I say if I had a little kid? What would I say to my children if they were young? I knew I was going to die in a few minutes, but I wanted to leave them with a thought.
This you should know, that like the sea, the ebb and flow of life will be a mystery. There will be times you cannot see the shore, but only then will new horizons bring you home.
I wanted to leave them with something that they would remember me by, and so that's where the song came from.
And you put this musical together, and it's going to open in September, but you tried to provide what a cross-section of different points of view and the different ways that people reacted.
So as a composer, as somebody who writes lyrics to whatever it is, a song or a Broadway show, I can't help but bring my own personal experience into the story. And so in This Is Not a Drill, in the musical, there's a young mom who's going through a troubled time in her marriage, and her children are back on the mainland, and she's taking a little break for herself in Hawaii. And then there's an older couple whose marriage has gotten a little bit dull, and they're feeling disappointed. There's a Hawaii family there, a young family, who are trying to deal with cultural issues in Hawaii, working in the tourist industry and having feelings about that. There is in the show he's called the anonymous button guy, but the guy who pushed the button, who pushed the alert. So all the characters are either from the actual story or from my life.
I don't know how difficult it was to bring this on stage. You had these perspectives and you're trying to distill them, right, in those
yes.
moments that people got that alert.
I will tell you, it's the most difficult thing I've ever done. I will put that very simply. It took me 2 years to write it. Of course, I have some co-writers who are absolutely amazing. Kathy Babylon co-wrote 10 songs. Joe McDonough co-wrote the script with me. And another friend of mine, John Vester, co-wrote 4 of the songs with me. And then I wrote by myself 2 of the songs. So it was a lot of work from a lot of people, and right now the production team that we have in New York and the cast is amazing. So that's really exciting. The director's name is Gabriel Berry. He works quite a bit with a man named Frank Wildhorn, who's the composer of the musical Jekyll and Hyde. If you've heard of it, it's a very famous Broadway show about the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. But he's so creative and so innovative. And so really This Is Not a Drill. What I'm so proud of about the show is that there's something for everyone in the show. You know, anyone who's missed their children, anyone who's wondered if that's all there is to their marriage. Oh, and there's a gay couple in the show also. And they came to Hawaii for the first time because they were heartbroken because they had a failed adoption in their hometown of Cincinnati, and they were both so heartbroken, they were just like, let's get out of here, and they went to Hawaii. So there's funny parts, and there are parts that literally, I've had a person sitting next to me at a reading who was sobbing into his hands. So there's the full gamut of emotions in the show, which I think is what music and art and live theater is all about, right?
Well, is there any chance that you might bring this show to Hawaii?
I really want to. I'm talking with Diamond Head Theater and the Hawaii Theater Center. I love both of those theaters. I would love to bring it to Hawaii. I think people there on the island in Honolulu would love the show. It would be a great thing for people to come see. It would tell a relevant story that many people had experienced. And funny enough, so it's been 7 years since that happened, Catherine, and a lot of people on the mainland had forgotten about it.
Well, we have not. And I recall that morning I was about to go out with my swimming group and we were going to take a group picture, and I hand someone my phone and they said, oh, we're going to get hit by a missile. There's an alert out. Yeah. This is not a drill. And one of the guys in our group who had survived a shark attack said, I don't care. I'm going swimming. Yeah, so many reactions in our small little group on dealing with, is this for real? So, yeah, I imagine if you can bring this show to Hawaii, it will bring back many memories for so many people.
I tell you, that would be a dream come true for me, first of all, because that's the location. But second of all, I love Hawaii so much. It is literally my favorite place. So it would be a dream to have it there. Oh, interestingly, just reminding me about the guy that had been attacked by a shark. I've talked to, obviously, lots of people in Hawaii who remember that day. And like you're saying, so many different responses. Some people like me, I wanted to survive. I wanted to live, you know, and I was trying to figure out a way to survive it. But a lot of people I talked to were like, yeah, we just went down to the beach. Or, yeah, I didn't do anything. I just figured it wouldn't help me to do anything. So, you know, what's the point? So really a full range of emotions. But I will tell you, when I was standing in that room, and funny enough, the room was very small, the room that had four walls that we ran to, the room was very small, and it was a crush of people standing in there shoulder to shoulder.
Wow.
So everybody had the same idea I did. But what I thought was really unique about it was, as I was standing there, I was thinking to myself, well, if this is how my life ends, looking back, I have no regrets. I've had a really fun life. My children are grown, so they don't, you know, they would miss me, but they don't need me anymore. And so if this is how I go, then so be it. May it be quick.
That was Holly Dubay, who wrote a musical about the day that a state worker issued a false missile alert 7 years ago. The show opens at the York Theater September 9th and runs through October 11th. Check our website later today for links to find out more. Well, that's a wrap for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from Senator Brian Schatz. Share your comments or questions about what you heard on our show by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.